WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Michael Beachel from the University of St. Francis on the topic of virology. Thank you for listening. Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. The last time I recorded an in-session conversation in person, the guest and I both wore masks. It's been a challenging year and a half. We are able to have this conversation in the same studio space today, and I am across from Michael Beachel, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of St. Francis. Welcome.
Thanks, Ben. It's very much a pleasure for me to be here, and I'm really excited for this opportunity.
This is probably where I should include a full disclosure. You and I are both proud USF alumni, and I believe you have a disclaimer you want to put at the top before we dive into our conversation.
I'd like to just say that the discussion that we're about to have today really are my ideas, and they don't necessarily reflect the ideas or beliefs of St. Francis or of this broadcast. And I certainly would like to also say that the discussion that we're going to have is certainly not political in nature, and we're just going to try to stick to just the facts.
And we'll hit on that last piece later in the conversation. This past March, you were invited to speak as part of the Aboit USF Lecture Series, which hosts faculty members from the University of St. Francis as they share their expertise with the public. And the topic you chose was COVID-19, a once-in-a-century pandemic. Let's start with some of the history. What are some of the biggest parallels you see between what we've experienced of COVID and, say, the last time we had a global pandemic?
I think if you look at previous pandemics, it's pretty interesting to see when we talk about parallels, some of the things kind of line up almost exactly. So when you look back at the Spanish flu pandemic, for example, in 1918, there actually were masking laws that were created. And much like we see in today's environment, there were anti-masking groups. There were a lot of discussions on, you know, personal freedoms and rights and such, in addition to just global disruption of the economy, people's daily lives. And so in a lot of ways, what we've seen with COVID, we've seen before in previous pandemics. And the parallels, when you actually read into the histories, are quite striking.
We hear a lot about the unprecedented nature of our current pandemic. And pandemics have been an issue throughout history. Could you walk us through a bit of the history of pandemics? I guess you could say perhaps from as recently as the AIDS crisis, and maybe even going as far back as the bubonic plague.
I think that's important to realize is that pandemics have been part of human history. Going back as far as we keep records, we can see that pandemics have occurred. A great place to start is with just kind of having an understanding of what a pandemic is. And so that's where you're having an infection and a severe presentation of disease across the globe, across a large amount of space, not necessarily defined by borders or anything by that. But when it comes to the unprecedented nature, I think that's something important to discuss. I would say that it's unprecedented for us right now. This is the first time that people have lived through a pandemic. There are some people that made it through Spanish flu, but a lot of people don't remember the global disruption. When we look at other pandemics that we've seen throughout history, you mentioned the AIDS crisis, right? That one also was a bit different. It wasn't respiratory. You know, it's not a respiratory infection. So that component changed things. And when we had the pandemic, the AIDS pandemic start, there was a lot of confusion. There was a lot of misinformation. And it ultimately turned into fear. We saw the LGBTQ community targeted over false information, right? And it really shaped the narrative early in the HIV crisis. And I think that's something that we have to be aware of with this current pandemic is that we don't have all the facts yet. We don't have all the information yet. We are truly living through a pandemic together. And we should try to make decisions and off of facts, out of the science, and move forward from there.
One idea that I know I've seen throughout the pandemic and everybody interacting throughout all of this online and trying to understand what is going on, and that's the idea of when we see information change, it means that science is working, not that it isn't.
I think a very important part of science is realizing that science takes the data that's available for it at the time that it's available. And as you get more information, your ideas, theories, and thoughts may change. And people aren't used to that, I think, with science. They're used to reading about it in a textbook. However, as we learn more about this virus and this pandemic, we really are in a position where the virus itself is changing. Our understanding of the virus is changing. How we treat the disease that the virus causes is changing. And I think a lot of people get frustrated and confused when they're told something one month, and then the next month they may be given different or even contradictory advice. What that ultimately means, though, is that the science is progressing, our understanding is progressing, and we're getting a better hold of how to address this viral infection.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Michael Beachel, and this episode is Virology, Lesson 1. In your talk at the Aboit Library, you mentioned you did research at the CDC, which has many connections to our topic for today. Can you talk a little bit about that journey?
Sure. As we mentioned earlier, I am from the University of St. Francis, and after I finished up my bachelor's there, I had a concentration in molecular and cellular biology. I went off to do my PhD in medical microbiology and immunology, and part of that is they actually have CDC labs where I was. And I think that's something that most people don't realize, is the CDC has labs commissioned across the country. And in that experience, I got to do research on various airborne infectious agents and figure out how they're good at kind of getting into people, infecting them, the illnesses and diseases that they cause, and is there any treatment or therapeutic that we could possibly apply to make those agents less deadly. That time in the CDC lab was lengthy. You're talking a lot of hours in the lab, and it sounds cool. Like in the movies, you see everybody in the spacesuits, you know, the Tyvek spacesuits and all of that. But after the first several days of, 12 to 15 hour days, it starts to wear off. The novelty wears off. But there's always that underlying seriousness that you're doing research on something that potentially could kill you. So I did research in the CDC lab. It was a BSL-3 environment for about five and a half years before I came back to St. Francis to start teaching there. And so it was a really great time to learn a lot of intricate detail about airborne infectious disease and, you know, how do these things spread? How do they interact with the host? And how do they make you sick?
One virus in particular has obviously been on our minds for the past year, but before we get to things specific to COVID-19, could you talk a little bit about viruses in general and how they work? And again, building off of as much of your experience with the CDC and after as you would like to.
Yeah, I think something when we talk about viruses to start off with is to realize that they're genetic programs. Much like a program on a computer or an app on your phone, they are simply following a genetic code. When I teach my virology course, we emphasize very much that viruses aren't really considered alive. They're not really considered dead. There's something in between because they're essentially a computer program running inside of your body. But at the most general basic level, all viruses have to follow kind of a similar process. They have to attach to the host. After they attach, they have to get in, unfold more or less, unpack their genetic material, and then start making copies of themselves as fast as they can. Some viruses have tricks to evade your immune response and survive in certain cell types, but at the end of the day, they're trying to make copies of themselves and then to release more into the environment to go infect other cells. So in reality, when you start to think of viruses as these kind of programs that run, it kind of gives you a strategy of, if I want to understand or even attack that virus, you should go after one of those steps, because all of the viruses will follow those steps in general.
Could you talk a little bit more about what coronaviruses are, specifically different varieties of them, and perhaps even previous coronavirus outbreaks?
So coronaviruses are kind of a neat. They're part of a family of viruses called the coronaviridae, but they actually got their name because they have these very large spike proteins coming out of them, which are important in how they infect us. But those spike proteins, when we scan them with electron microscopes, they look like a crown. And so hence the name coronavirus. But when we look at the different types of coronaviruses, coronaviruses are pretty prevalent around the world. We didn't really start to identify the first coronaviruses until the early 30s. And it was actually in chickens where coronaviruses were first identified. In general, their properties, they're large. They're some of the largest viruses that we know of. Their genetic material can be upwards of 25, 30,000 kilobases, so thousands of bases. Pairs of genetic information. Most of them, if they infect people, don't make you sick. So historically, coronaviruses, most people would be asymptomatic if they had a coronavirus infection. However, that all changed around 2002. We had a new kind of coronavirus take hold. And the virus was called SARS-CoV-1, and it caused the disease SARS. So this outbreak happened starting again around 2001, 2002, and it was in Asia, so Southeast Asian countries, and it took off pretty quickly. And what was kind of frightening about SARS was it had around a 10% mortality rate. That's significantly higher than what SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19, what we're experiencing right now, at least on paper. So that was kind of our first warning sign, was, you know, the SARS virus came out. Then it peaked. We got containment in Southeast Asia, and we were able to more or less alleviate that pandemic. Then shortly after that, around 2014, a new coronavirus came out called MERS-CoV-1, and this caused the disease MERS, or Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. MERS was scary. The mortality rate with MERS was upwards of 30 to 35%. Luckily, it didn't spread very well. And so once it was identified as, you know, a coronavirus outbreak and it was highly deadly, we worked very hard to get it under containment. And again, we were able to contain that virus, and cases of MERS aren't common anymore. Then we saw, you know, right at the tail end of 2019, we saw a new coronavirus come out. And again, in Southeast Asia, and it was much more infectious than the first two human transmissible coronaviruses. And the name that we gave to this virus is SARS-CoV-2. SARS-CoV-2 is the virus that causes the disease COVID-19. And as we've all experienced, very quickly, we lost containment out of Southeast Asia and it's spread globally. But when you look at coronaviruses, it's important to realize that there's a large assortment of them, a large family of them. Many of the human coronaviruses might give you a minor cold. 20 to 25% of human common colds are believed to be caused by coronaviruses. The rest are from rhinoviruses. But these human transmissible respiratory viruses, such as SARS, MERS, and then COVID-19, they can get very serious.
With that foundation laid, I do want to talk a little bit more specifically about what we've seen with SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 and how they work and how people can become infected, and especially given that it has become a global pandemic. And because this has been something that so many of us have been grappling with for the last year and a half, let's focus on that a little bit.
So when we talk about SARS-CoV-2, the way that it gets into the human body is by binding to a specific receptor called the ACE2 receptor. The ACE2 receptor, or an angiotensin II receptor, is present on certain cells in the body. And this is a very important part of viral infections. So for a virus to get into a human cell, it has to come in contact with a specific protein on the surface of that cell. I like to call it a lock and key mechanism. And if that fit isn't perfect, the virus can't infect you. And so in order for a SARS-CoV-2 infection to happen, that virus has to come in contact with an appropriate human cell. Now, unfortunately, that ACE2 receptor is found throughout your entire respiratory tract. So your nose, your throat, your lungs are coated with ACE2 receptors. So it's a very easy opportunity for the virus to get in. Something else to just be aware of is that ACE2 receptors are also throughout your GI tract. So as we learn more about these viral outbreaks, we're seeing that SARS-CoV-2 is actually found very prevalently throughout the digestive system and many of your body systems in general. Now, once that virus gets into your cells, it's going to start making copies of it. Like we had mentioned earlier, viruses are going to basically be glorified copy machines, making copies of themselves inside of your own host cell. They're hijacking your host cell to kind of take over. Now, as they do that, you're going to start to show symptoms. You're going to start to get sick, and that the disease that you present with is, we call it COVID-19. So COVID-19 can present as a wide range. And, you know, why some people are asymptomatic when other people unfortunately lose their lives, that range, we're still trying to figure out why and how that's happening. But what we're seeing with COVID-19 is that a lot of people will just have minor respiratory issues, cough, sore throat, stuff like that. However, there are other people that have severe respiratory distress, and this is something to be concerned about. With the latest medical treatments that we know of, we know that trying to avoid intubation and avoid ventilators as much as possible is important. But if that respiratory distress is occurring, it's a warning sign. In addition to that, we are also seeing people with neurological symptoms. So I was just reading a paper about this last night where it just came out in Nature, where COVID actually can get into the brain, and it seems to prefer the gray matter of the brain, which is your consciousness, where your consciousness comes from. And it causes what people are referring to as a COVID fog, right? And I've actually experienced this with my students, where students have gotten COVID, and when they come back, they present almost like they had a concussion. And they're very foggy and cloudy, have trouble thinking and processing quickly, sometimes taking upwards of 30 seconds to process a question that you ask them. And so that COVID fog is very, very real. And we're just on the cusp of really understanding that these are actually an inflammation of the gray matter in your brain, as well as another type of immune cell in your brain called astrocytes. Those are also infected. In addition to the neurological COVID-19, we're unfortunately seeing cardiac issues. So some people are experiencing an inflammation of their cardiac muscle in their heart. Other people are having clotting issues and henceforth suffering from strokes and other clotting disorders. And so what I'm trying to get at here is that COVID-19 is not a single set of presentations, and it's not a single set of severities. I think we've seen this on the news. But exactly why some people can have COVID and not even know that they have it, and then there's the other extreme where we know of entire families that have unfortunately passed away in a week. Stuff like that points to some type of a genetic predisposition, but we don't at this point know exactly what that predisposition is.
I know for a lot of us, the experience of the pandemic changed towards the end of 2020 and into 2021 once vaccines were made available. And vaccination is something that is something of a contentious issue in this country. Could you talk a little bit, let's just start at a baseline of what vaccines are, how they're made, and how they work?
The goal of a vaccine is to show your immune system what a future threat might look like. And so what you're trying to do is, in a controlled situation through a vaccination, show your body's immune system, hey, if you ever encounter something that looks like this, you might want to react to it, all right? And in that controlled setting, you can generate antibodies, and then in a subsequent exposure, be ready to fight it quickly. The goal with any vaccination is to try to prevent, first off, death, second off, hospitalization. If you could prevent severe illness symptoms, that would be good. And then very, very rarely does a vaccination completely prevent anything, but they can occur. Vaccinations in and of themselves, there's a range of them. There are activated vaccines, inactivated vaccines, but something that's been new with the COVID-19 vaccination campaign is that we have a new style of vaccine called an mRNA vaccine. So you may have heard of vaccinations such as the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccination. These are mRNA vaccines. And what an mRNA vaccination is going to do is it's going to deliver a piece of mRNA into your body. Your cells will then read that piece of mRNA. It's a small piece of genetic material, basically. And it will translate that into a portion of the spike protein that is on the surface of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And so what you're doing is you're teaching your immune system how to make antibodies against that SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. Some of the controversy surrounding this vaccination is that this is a new technology, and it is. It's been being developed for the last 5, 10, maybe 15 years, and this is the first mass delivery of it. So that part of it, I understand, certainly people have apprehension about. The other part of vaccination that I think people struggle with is the speed in which these vaccinations have been created. So a typical vaccine takes about a decade for you to develop. The fastest vaccination that was created ever was around 4 years. The fastest recent vaccination that we were able to create recently was the Ebola vaccine. That took 5 years and, $1 billion. So people ask, if this is the standard for the vaccination industry, how have we created vaccines in 1 year? And I think that draws a lot of the concerns. So when it comes to the COVID-19 vaccine, I think people think generally that, well, we just magically created a vaccine out of thin air in 1 year. And in reality, it couldn't be farther from the truth. What you have to realize is that this isn't our first trip with coronaviruses, right? As we discussed earlier, we had SARS-CoV-1, we had MERS, and now we're dealing with the SARS-CoV-2. We also tried to make vaccines against SARS-CoV-1 and against MERS as well. In matter of fact, we put 96 vaccinations into phase 3 clinical trials for SARS-CoV-1. And so we've learned a lot of tricks when going after coronaviruses. So the first trick that we learned in that almost 20 years of studying human-to-human transmissible coronaviruses was that you have to go after the spike protein, that nice big spike that's sticking out of the top of the virus. You have to go after that. And so when the sequence for coronaviruses was published on the internet by a Chinese laboratory, the world immediately latched onto that. Scientists around the world said, all right, we have the genetic sequence of this virus. We need to, as fast as we can, create something against the spike protein. So we already had a very small directed area in which to create a vaccine against. Then there were labs around the world that literally were operating 24 hours a day doing basically is artificial intelligence, computational computer work to say, what is the three-dimensional structure of this spike protein look like? And in a record amount of time, in a month, they were able to come up with what does the spike protein look like. And from the time that they demonstrated the shape of that spike protein to creating the first vaccine and injecting the first phase 1 clinical trial patient, it was 14 days. And then we went into the phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials as required by the FDA. Now, again, people have said this has happened in a very, very short period of time. Another aspect to this that has allowed the vaccination campaign to happen so quickly is the money involved. There have been billions and billions of dollars globally put into companies to create a vaccine as quickly as possible. So normally a company will only invest into a vaccine if they think it's going to be successful, because you're talking a minimum of $1 billion and you have to answer to shareholders, is basically what it comes down to. However, when it comes to this coronavirus vaccination campaign, it's more or less a blank check. Make us vaccinations that work as quickly as you possibly can. So instead of waiting till after phase three clinical trials to manufacture vaccines, as soon as they started clinical trial one, manufacturing began. You know, we already had 20 years of previous research to know that we had to go after the spike protein. So this isn't starting with a blank slate. When it came to COVID-19, we had 2 decades of previous experience on how to develop a new vaccine. And personally, I've been shocked at how effective these vaccines have been. It's striking the number of people that have been vaccinated and are being protected is nearly unprecedented. The phase three data coming out of Pfizer and Moderna was over 96% effective and 100% effective at preventing hospitalizations and 100% effective at preventing deaths. And that is simply unprecedented. So really, really neat thing.
We've heard that a lot of these steps were happening simultaneously. And as you said, were based off of decades of available research that had already been done. What do each of the different phases look like that you've mentioned when it comes to the creation and the production of a vaccine?
So the first stage is just simple toxicology. Does the vaccine make you sick, or is it toxic to your cells? So the first thing that you'll do is toxicology studies. That's typically done in a petri dish, right, with human cell lines and such. After you can show that the vaccine is not toxic, then you can apply for patents and other legal protections, and then move, once you have the funding, into clinical trials. Phase one is the first step of the clinical trials that you go into. And phase one clinical trials are typically a very small group of people. We're talking 10, a dozen, maybe 2 dozen individuals, in which you are giving them the vaccination and making sure that there aren't significant side effects. That's kind of the very first part, making sure that you don't see other health effects that aren't intended in that small subset of people. And then you say, well, do I see the efficacy? Is the vaccine actually doing any protecting or not? And after you realize that it's safe, you can move towards phase two clinical trials, where instead of injecting maybe a dozen people with that vaccination, you're going to move to hundreds of people. And with those hundreds of people, you're asking the same safety questions. But then at the same time, you're seeing, do you get any type of protection? There's a bunch of biostatistical analysis that's done to say, are these patients healthier than the placebo group? You always have a placebo group that is unvaccinated or gets basically a saline or water vaccine versus the experimental group, which gets the actual vaccine. And you run statistics on, are these people actually healthier or not? If you don't see any red flags or warning signs and you actually are seeing a benefit, then you can be permitted, again, by the FDA to move into phase three clinical trials. In phase three clinical trials, you're injecting tens of thousands of people. The Pfizer vaccination, for example, there was over 80,000 people in the phase three clinical trial. And after that phase three clinical trial wrapped up, the companies apply for what's called emergency use authorization. Emergency use authorization allows you to speed up the process even further, where you could provide vaccinations to the public in an emergency like the current pandemic we're in, and get full authorization later. So several of the vaccines that were first to market, so you look at, you know, Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, they have actually moved through that emergency use authorization period and are now in full authorization now. And so that's kind of what the process looks like from step to step to step. The goal at the end is, are people protected? Are they healthier having the vaccination versus not having the vaccination. And that's where the efficacy data comes out in, that you saw in the library presentation.
During your presentation at the Avoyt branch of the Allen County Public Library, as well as earlier on in our conversation today, you talked about how your presentation wouldn't be political. I think that's a barrier that a lot of people have run into when it comes to talking about COVID-19 with friends, family, people that we might have spent a lot of time with before the pandemic, who maybe we aren't now. How would you construct a conversational roadmap for talking about the virus with people that we disagree with and without getting into the politics?
One of the most unfortunate parts of our current pandemic is that it happened during an election cycle. It politicized the topic, and unfortunately, that's created issues when we try to address and fight this pandemic. I'd like to just say that viruses in general have no way of interpreting or knowing what your personal beliefs are, what your political beliefs are. As we've mentioned before, their job is to get into your cells, take over, and make copies of themselves. And so I think knowing that at the beginning is a good starting point, is remove politics from the conversation completely. And you have to ask yourself the question, what does the science say? What does the data say? And am I protected? Because at the end of the day, the goal of a vaccination is to prevent death, prevent hospitalization, prevent long-term effects. And you have to play kind of a risk versus benefit game. Is any vaccine at all 100% effective? No. There isn't a vaccine that's 100% effective. Is there a vaccine that's even 100% safe? No. Unfortunately not. People sometimes have adverse effects to vaccination. But at the end of the day, we know that unvaccinated people with this current pandemic have a very significantly higher chance of getting severely sick or even dying of COVID-19. And if people are vaccinated, we know that their risk of being hospitalized or dying is nearly nothing. I don't know if this exactly fits the topic that we're talking about, but another example that I teach about in class is the Gardasil vaccination. So Gardasil is against HPV, or human papillomavirus, the number one cause of cervical cancer around the globe. Over 90% of cervical cancers are because of HPV. If people have the HPV vaccine, data shows over the last decade that their chances of getting cervical cancer are nearly nothing. At the same time, there have been several people that have gotten the Gardasil vaccine, had a very adverse effect, and unfortunately passed away. And so as an individual and as a general public, we have to ask ourselves a question. Is the risk, that small risk, that a person here or there will unfortunately have a very severe adverse side effect to a vaccine, worth the benefit of the protection that the vaccine offers? So in the case of the HPV vaccination campaign, saving millions of lives that would otherwise be lost to cervical cancer is one side of the coin. But the other side of the coin is that unfortunately, several times there have been people that have had their daughters vaccinated and had to deal with the consequences of very severe effects. And so that's, I think, the question that people have to ask is the benefit outweighing the risk? I have personally had friends of our family that were not vaccinated, did not believe in COVID or SARS-CoV-2, that unfortunately have passed from this infection. I've seen the personal impact that that has had on people. You work with any community member that's in the hospital settings, and they can tell you they've seen the impact of COVID. And so we should ask ourselves the question, is the benefit of the vaccination worth any potential risk? And at this time, there's no real clear sign of permanent risk to people that are getting this vaccination.
Michael Beachell, thank you so much for your time today. I know that I learned a lot from our conversation. I hope others did as well. There are a lot of issues and areas that we've certainly heard about, especially coming from NPR and Indiana Public Broadcasting in our own newsroom, that you have reaffirmed. There's also some areas of additional focus that I'm glad we were able to highlight today. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. You can find more episodes of WBOI Presents in Session at WBOI.org. And while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team and stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. This episode was produced with help from WBOI intern Lewis Ritchie. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship, Alex Costanzo, Steve Mullaney, Kyle Norbeck, Mariah Roberts, Diamond Thomas, Michaela Veltum, and Sydney Wagner. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI Fort Wayne.